in Denmark. The divided worldview is 20 years older, 20 years more outdated. We're live on air, and the journalist tilts his head and says to me, "We still see an enormous difference between the small, rich world, the old Western world mostly, and then the large part." "But you're totally wrong," I reply. Once more, I explain that poor developing countries no longer exist as a distinct group, that there is no gap. Today, most people, 75%, live in middle-income countries, not poor, not rich, but somewhere in the middle, and starting to live a reasonable life. At one end of the scale, there are still countries with the majority living in extreme and unacceptable poverty. At the other is the wealthy world of North America and Europe and a few others like Japan, South Korea, and Singapore. But the vast majority are already in the middle. "And what do you base that knowledge on?" continued the journalist in an obvious attempt to be provocative, and he succeeded. I couldn't help getting irritated, and my agitation showed in my voice and my words. "I use normal statistics that are compiled by the World Bank and the United Nations. This is not controversial. These facts are not up for discussion. I am right, and you are wrong." Capturing the Beast. Now that I have been fighting the misconception of a divided world for 20 years, I am no longer surprised when I encounter it. My students were not special. The Danish journalist was not special. The vast majority of the people I meet think like this. If you are skeptical about my claim that so many people get it wrong, that's good. You should always require evidence for claims like this. And here it is, in the form of a two-part misconception trap. First, we had people disclose how they imagined life in so-called low-income countries by asking questions like this one from the test you did in the introduction. Fact question one: in all low-income countries across the world today, how many girls finish primary school? A. 20%. B. 40%. C. 60%. On average, just 7% pick the correct answer. C. 60% of girls finish primary school in low-income countries. Remember, 33% of the chimps at the zoo would have gotten this question right. A majority of people guessed that it was just 20%. There are only a very few countries in the world, exceptional places like Afghanistan or South Sudan, where fewer than 20% of girls finish primary school. And at most, 2% of the world's girls live in such countries. When we ask similar questions about life expectancy, undernourishment, water quality, and vaccination rates, essentially asking what proportion of people in low-income countries had access to the basic first steps toward a modern life, we got the same kinds of results. Life expectancy in low-income countries is 62 years. Most people have enough to eat. Most people have access to improved water. Most children are vaccinated, and most girls finish primary school. Only tiny percentages, way less than the chimps' 33%, got these answers right, and large majorities picked the worst alternative we offered, even when those numbers represented levels of misery now being suffered only during terrible catastrophes in the very worst places on Earth. Now let's close the trap and capture the misconception. We now know that people believe that life in low-income countries is much worse than it actually is. But how many people do they imagine live such terrible lives? We asked people in Sweden and the United States. Of the world population, what percentage lives in low-income countries? The majority suggested the answer was 50% or more. The average guess was 59%. The real figure is 9%. Only 9% of the world lives in low-income countries. And remember, we just worked out that those countries are not nearly as terrible as people think. They are really bad in many ways, but they are not at or below the level of Afghanistan, Somalia, or Central African Republic, the worst places to live on the planet. To summarize, low-income countries are much more developed than most people think, and vastly fewer people live in them. The idea of a divided world with the majority stuck in misery and deprivation is an illusion, a complete misconception, simply wrong. Help! The majority is missing. If the majority doesn't live in low-income countries, then where does it live? Surely not in high-income countries. How do you like your bathwater? Ice cold or steam hot? Of course, those are not the only alternatives. You could also have your water freezing, tepid, scalding, or anything in between. Many options along a range. Fact question 2. Where does the majority of the world population live? A. Low-income countries. B. Middle-income countries. C. High-income countries. The majority of people live neither in low-income countries nor in high-income countries, but in middle-income countries. This category doesn't exist in the divided mindset, but in reality, it definitely exists. It's where 75% of humanity lives, right there where the gap is supposed to be. Or to put it another way, there is no gap. Combining middle and high-income countries, that makes 91% of humanity, most of whom have integrated into the global market and made great progress toward decent lives. This is a happy realization for humanitarians and a crucial realization for global businesses. There are 5 billion potential consumers out there, improving their lives in the middle and wanting to consume shampoo, motorcycles, menstrual pads, and smartphones. You can easily miss them if you go around thinking they are poor. So what should we call them instead? The four levels. I am often quite rude about the term developing countries in my presentations. Afterward, people ask me, so what should we call them instead? But listen carefully. It's the same misconception. We and them. What should we call them instead? What we should do is stop dividing countries into two groups. It doesn't make sense anymore. It doesn't help us to understand the world in a practical way. It doesn't help businesses find opportunities, and it doesn't help aid money to find the poorest people. But we need to do some kind of sorting to make sense of the world. We can't give up our old labels and replace them with nothing. What should we do? One reason the old labels are so popular is that they are so simple, but they are wrong. So to replace them, I will now suggest an equally simple but more relevant and useful way of dividing up the world. Instead of dividing the world into two groups, I will divide it into four income levels. Most people are living on the two middle levels, where people have most of their basic human needs met. Are you excited? You should be, because the four income levels are the first most important part of your new fact-based framework. They are one of the simple thinking tools I promised would help you to guess better about the world. Throughout the book, you will see how the levels provide a simple way to understand all kinds of things, from terrorism to sex education. So I want to try to explain what life is like on each of these four levels. Think of the four income levels as the levels of a computer game. Everyone wants to move from level 1 to level 2 and upward through the levels from there. Only, it's a very strange computer game, because level 1 is the hardest. Let's play. Level 1. You start on level 1 with $1 per day. Your 5 children have to spend hours walking barefoot with your single plastic bucket back and forth to fetch water from a dirty mud hole an hour's walk away. On their way home, they gather firewood, and you prepare the same gray porridge that you've been eating at every meal, every day, for your whole life. Except during the months when the meager soil yielded no crops and you went to bed hungry. One day, your youngest daughter develops a nasty cough. Smoke from the indoor fire is weakening her lungs. You can't afford antibiotics. And 1 month later, she is dead. This is extreme poverty. Yet you keep struggling on. If you are lucky and the yields are good, you can maybe sell some surplus crops and manage to earn more than $2 a day, which would move you to the next level. Good luck. Roughly 1 billion people live like this today. Level 2. You've made it. In fact, you've quadrupled your income, and now you earn $4 a day. 3 extra dollars every day. What are you going to do with all this money? Now that you can buy food that you didn't grow yourself, and you can afford chickens, which means eggs, you save some money, and you buy sandals for your children, and a bike, and more plastic buckets. Now it takes you only half an hour to fetch water for the day. You buy a gas stove so your children can attend school instead of gathering wood. When there's power, they do their homework under a bulb. But the electricity is too unstable for a freezer. You save up for mattresses, so you don't have to sleep on the mud floor. Life is much better now, but still very uncertain. A single illness, and you would have to sell most of your possessions to buy medicine. That would throw you back to level 1 again. Another $3 a day would be good. But to experience really drastic improvement, you need to quadruple again. If you can land a job in the local garment industry, you will be the first member of your family to bring home a salary. Roughly 3 billion people live like this today. Level 3. Wow. You did it. You work multiple jobs, 16 hours a day, 7 days a week, and manage to quadruple your income again to $16 a day. Your savings are impressive, and you install a cold water tap. No more fetching water. With a stable electric line, the kids' homework improves, and you can buy a fridge that lets you store food and serve different dishes each day. You save to buy a motorcycle, which means you can travel to a better-paying job at a factory in town. Unfortunately, you crash on your way there one day, and you have to use money you had saved for your children's education to pay the medical bills. You recover, and thanks to your savings, you are not thrown back a level. Two of your children start high school. if they manage to finish, they will be able to get better-paying jobs than you have ever had. To celebrate, you take the whole family on its first-ever vacation, one afternoon, to the beach, just for fun. Roughly 2 billion people live like this today. Level 4. You have more than $64 a day. You are a rich consumer, and $3 more a day makes very little difference to your everyday life. That's why you think $3, which can change the life of someone living in extreme poverty, is not a lot of money. You have more than 12 years of education, and you have been on an airplane on vacation. You can eat out once a month, and you can buy a car. Of course, you can have hot and cold water indoors. But you know about this level already, since you are reading this book. I'm pretty sure you live on level 4. I don't have to describe it for you to understand. The difficulty, when you have always known this high level of income, is to understand the huge differences between the other three levels. People on level 4 must struggle hard not to misunderstand the reality of the other 6 billion people in the world. Roughly 1 billion people live like this today. I've described the progress up the levels as if one person managed to move through several levels. That is very unusual. Often it takes several generations for a family to move from level 1 to level 4. I hope, though, that you now have a clear picture of the kinds of lives people live on different levels, a sense that it is possible to move through the levels, both for individuals and for countries, and above all, the understanding that there are not just two kinds of lives. Human history started with everyone on level 1. For more than 100,000 years, nobody made it up the levels, and most children didn't survive to become parents. Just 200 years ago, 85% of the world population was still on level 1, in extreme poverty. Today, the vast majority of people are spread out in the middle, across levels 2 and 3. With the same range of standards of living as people had in Western Europe and North America in the 1950s. And this has been the case for many years. The gap instinct. The gap instinct is very strong. The first time I lectured to the staff of the World Bank was in 1999. I told them the labels developing and developed were no longer valid, and I swallowed my sword. It took the World Bank 17 years and 14 more of my lectures before it finally announced publicly that it was dropping the terms developing and developed, and would, from now on, divide the world into 4 income groups. The UN and most other global organizations have still not made this change. So why is the misconception of a gap between the rich and the poor so hard to change? I think this is because human beings have a strong, dramatic instinct toward binary thinking, a basic urge to divide things into 2 distinct groups with nothing but an empty gap in between. We love to dichotomize good versus bad, heroes versus villains, my country versus the rest. Dividing the world into 2 distinct sides is simple and intuitive, and also dramatic, because it implies conflict, and we do it without thinking all the time. Journalists know this. They set up their narratives as conflicts between 2 opposing people, views, or groups. They prefer stories of extreme poverty and billionaires to stories about the vast majority of people slowly dragging themselves toward better lives. Journalists are storytellers. So are people who produce documentaries and movies. Documentaries pit the fragile individual against the big evil corporation. Blockbuster movies usually feature good fighting evil. The gap instinct makes us imagine division where there is just a smooth range, difference where there is convergence, and conflict where there is agreement. It is the first instinct on our list because it's so common and distorts the data so fundamentally. If you look at the news or click on a lobby group's website this evening, you will probably notice stories about conflict between two groups or phrases like the increasing gap. How to control the gap instinct. There are three common warning signs that someone might be telling you, or you might be telling yourself, an over-dramatic gap story and triggering your gap instinct. Let's call them comparisons of averages, comparisons of extremes, and the view from up here. Comparisons of averages. All you averages out there, please do not take offense at what I am about to say. I love averages. They are a quick way to convey information. They often tell us something useful. And modern societies couldn't function without them. Nor could this book. There will be many averages in this book. But any simplification of information may also be misleading, and averages are no exception. Averages mislead by hiding a spread, a range of different numbers, in a single number. When we compare two averages, we risk misleading ourselves even more by focusing on the gap between those two single numbers and missing the overlapping spreads, the overlapping ranges of numbers that make up each average. That is, we see gaps that are not really there. Let's take two graphs. One shows the gap between the average math scores of men and women taking SAT tests in the United States for every year since 1965. The other graph shows the gap between the average income of people living in Mexico and the United States. There are huge differences between the two lines in each graph, men versus women, United States versus Mexico. The graphs seem to show that men are better at math than women, and that people living in the United States have a higher income than Mexicans. And in a sense, this is true. It is what the numbers say. But in what sense? To what extent? Are all men better than all women? Are all U.S. citizens richer than all Mexicans? Let's get a better sense of the reality behind the numbers. First, let's change the scale. Using the same numbers, we can get a very different impression. The gap appears almost gone. Looking at the same data in another way, instead of looking at the averages each year, look at the range of math scores or incomes in a particular year. Now we get a sense of all the individuals who were bundled into the average number. There is an almost complete overlap between men and women's math scores. The majority of women have a male math twin, a man with the same math score as they do. When it comes to incomes in Mexico and the United States, the overlap is there, but it is only partial. What is clear, though, looking at the data this way, is that the two groups of people, men and women, Mexicans and people living in the United States, are not separate at all. They overlap. There is no gap. Of course, gap stories can reflect reality. In apartheid South Africa, black people and white people lived on different income levels, and there was a true gap between them, with almost no overlap. The gap story of separate groups was absolutely relevant. But apartheid was very unusual. Much more often, gap stories are a misleading over-dramatization. In most cases, there is no clear separation of two groups, even if it seems like that from the averages. We almost always get a more accurate picture by digging a little deeper and looking not just at the averages, but at the spread, not just the group all bundled together, but the individuals. Then we often see that apparently distinct groups are in fact very much overlapping. Comparisons of extremes. We are naturally drawn to extreme examples, and they are easy to recall. For example, if we are thinking about global inequality, we might think about the stories we have seen on the news about famine in South Sudan, on the one hand, and our own comfortable reality, on the other. If we are asked to think about different kinds of government systems, we might quickly recall, on the one hand, corrupt, oppressive dictatorships, and on the other hand, countries like Sweden, with great welfare systems and benevolent bureaucrats dedicating their lives to safeguarding the rights of all citizens. These stories of opposites are engaging and provocative and tempting, and very effective for triggering our gap instinct. But they rarely help understanding. There will always be the richest and the poorest. There will always be the worst regimes and the best. But the fact that extremes exist doesn't tell us much. The majority is usually to be found in the middle, and it tells a very different story. Take Brazil, one of the world's most unequal countries. The richest 10% in Brazil earns 41% of the total income. Disturbing, right? It seems too high. We quickly imagine an elite stealing resources from all the rest. The media support that impression with images of the very richest, often not the richest 10%, but probably the richest 0.1%, the ultra-rich, and their boats, horses, and huge mansions. Yes, the number is disturbingly high. At the same time, it hasn't been this low for many years. Statistics are often used in dramatic ways for political purposes, but it's important that they also help us navigate reality. Let's now look at the incomes of the Brazilian population across the four levels. Most people in Brazil have left extreme poverty. The big hump is on level 3. That's where you get a motorbike and reading glasses, and save money in a bank to pay for high school, and someday buy a washing machine. In reality, even in one of the world's most unequal countries, there is no gap. Most people are in the middle. The view from up here. As I mentioned, if you are reading this book, you probably live on level 4. Even if you live in a middle-income country, meaning the average income is on level 2 or 3, like Mexico, for example, you yourself probably live on level 4, and your life is probably similar in important ways to the lives of the people living on level 4 in San Francisco, Stockholm, Rio, Cape Town, and Beijing. The thing known as poverty in your country is different from extreme poverty. It's relative poverty. In the United States, for example, people are classified as below the poverty line even if they live on level 3. So the struggles people go through on levels 1, 2, and 3 will most likely be completely unfamiliar to you. And they are not described in any helpful way in the mass media you consume. Of course, if you live on level 4 and have relatives living on level 2 and 3, you probably know what their lives look like. If so, you can skip this section. Your most important challenge in developing a fact-based worldview is to realize that most of your first-hand experiences are from level 4, and that your second-hand experiences are filtered through the mass media, which loves non-representative extraordinary events and shuns normality. When you live on level 4, everyone on levels 3, 2, and 1 can look equally poor, and the word poor can lose any specific meaning. Even a person on level 4 can appear poor. Maybe the paint on their walls is peeling, or maybe they are driving a used car. Anyone who has looked down from the top of a tall building knows that it is difficult to assess from there the differences in height of the buildings nearer the ground. They all look kind of small. In the same way, it is natural for people living on level 4 to see the world as divided into just two categories: rich, at the top of the building, like you, and poor, down there, not like you. It is natural to look down and say, "Oh, they are all poor." It is natural to miss the distinctions between the people with cars, the people with motorbikes and bicycles, the people with sandals, and the people with no shoes at all. I assure you, because I have met and talked with people who live on every level, that for the people living on the ground on levels 1, 2, and 3, the distinctions are crucial. People living in extreme poverty on level 1 know very well how much better life would be if they could move from $1 a day to $4 a day, not to mention $16 a day. People who have to walk everywhere on bare feet know how a bicycle would save them tons of time and effort and speed them to the market in town and to better health and wealth. The four-level framework, the replacement for the over-dramatic, divided worldview, is the first and most important part of the fact-based framework you will learn in this book. Now you have learned it. It isn't too difficult, is it? I will use the four levels throughout the rest of the book to explain all kinds of things, including elevators, drownings, sex, cookery, and rhinos. They will help you see the world more clearly and get it right more often. What do you need to hunt, capture, and replace misconceptions? Data. You have to show the data and describe the reality behind it. So thank you, UNICEF data tables, thank you, bubble graphs, and thank you, Internet. But you also need something more. Misconceptions disappear only if there is some equally simple but more relevant way of thinking to replace them. That's what the four levels do. Factfulness. Factfulness is recognizing when a story talks about a gap and remembering that this paints a picture of two separate groups with a gap in between. The reality is often not polarized at all. Usually the majority is right there in the middle, where the gap is supposed to be. To control the gap instinct, look for the majority. Beware comparisons of averages. If you could check the spreads, you would probably find they overlap. There is probably no gap at all. Beware comparisons of extremes. In all groups of countries or people, there are some at the top and some at the bottom. The difference is sometimes extremely unfair, but even then, the majority is usually somewhere in between, right where the gap is supposed to be. The view from up here. Remember, looking down from above distorts the view. Everything else looks equally short, but it's not. Chapter 2. The Negativity Instinct. How I was kind of born in Egypt, and what a baby in an incubator can teach us about the world. Which statement do you agree with most? A. The world is getting better. B. The world is getting worse. C. The world is getting neither better nor worse. getting out of the ditch. I remember being suddenly upside down. I remember the dark, the smell of urine, and being unable to breathe as my mouth and nostrils filled with mud. I remember struggling to turn myself upright, but only sinking deeper into the sticky liquid. I remember my arms stretched out behind me, desperately searching the grass for something to pull, then being suddenly hauled out by the ankles. My grandma putting me in the big sink on the kitchen floor and washing me gently with the hot water meant for the dishes, the scent of the soap. These are my earliest memories, and were nearly my last. They are memories of my rescue, aged 4, from the sewage ditch running in front of my grandma's house. It was filled to the brim with a mix of last night's rain and sewage slurry from the factory workers' township. Something in it had caught my attention, and stepping to the ditch's edge, I had slipped and fallen in head first. My parents were not around to keep an eye on me. My mother was in the hospital, ill with tuberculosis. My father worked 10 hours a day. During the week, I lived with my grandparents. On Saturdays, my daddy put me on the rack of his bike, and we drove in large circles and figures of 8 just for fun on our way to the hospital. I would see Mommy standing on the balcony on the 3rd floor, coughing. Daddy would explain that if we went in, we could get sick too. I would wave to her, and she would wave back. I saw her talking to me, but her voice was too weak, and her words were carried away by the wind. I remember that she always tried to smile. The mega misconception that the world is getting worse. This chapter is about the negativity instinct, our tendency to notice the bad more than the good. This instinct is behind the second mega misconception. Things are getting worse is the statement about the world that I hear more than any other. And it is absolutely true there are many bad things in this world. The number of war fatalities has been falling since the Second World War, but with the Syrian war, the trend has reversed. Terrorism, too, is rising again. We'll get back to that in Chapter 4. Overfishing and the deterioration of the seas are truly worrisome. The lists of dead areas in the world's oceans and of endangered species are getting longer. Ice is melting. Sea levels will continue to rise by probably 3 feet over the next 100 years. There's no doubt it's because of all the greenhouse gases humans have pumped into the atmosphere, which won't disperse for a long time, even if we stop adding more. The collapse of the U.S. housing market in 2007, which no regulators had predicted, was caused by widespread illusions of safety in abstract investments, which hardly anyone understood. The system remains as complex now as it was then, and a similar crisis could happen again. Maybe tomorrow. In order for this planet to have financial stability, peace, and protected natural resources, there's one thing that we can't do without, and that's international collaboration, based on a shared and fact-based understanding of the world. The current lack of knowledge about the world is therefore the most concerning problem of all. I hear so many negative things all the time. Maybe you think, Hans, you must just meet all the gloomiest people. We decided to check. People in 30 countries were asked the question at the top of the chapter, do you think the world is getting better, getting worse, or staying about the same? In all 30 countries, the majority of people answered, getting worse. I never trust data 100%, and you never should either. There is always some uncertainty. In this case, I'd say these numbers are roughly right, but you shouldn't jump to any conclusions based on small differences. By the way, that is a good general principle with statistics. Be careful jumping to any conclusions if the differences are smaller than, say, roughly 10%. The big picture is still crystal clear, though. The majority of people think the world is getting worse. No wonder we all feel stressed. Statistics as therapy. It is easy to be aware of all the bad things happening in the world. It's harder to know about the good things. Billions of improvements that are never reported. Don't misunderstand me. I'm not talking about some trivial positive news to supposedly balance out the negative. I'm talking about fundamental improvements that are world-changing, but are too slow, too fragmented, and too small one by one to ever qualify as news. I'm talking about the secret silent miracle of human progress. The basic facts about the world's progress are so little known that I get invited to talk about them at conferences and corporate meetings all over the world. They sometimes call my lectures inspirational, and many people say they also have a comforting effect. That was never my intention, but it's logical. What I show is mostly just official UN data. As long as people have a worldview that is so much more negative than reality, pure statistics can make them feel more positive. It is comforting, as well as inspiring, to learn that the world is much better than you think. A new kind of happy pill, completely free online. Extreme poverty. Let's start by looking at the trend for extreme poverty. Fact question 3. In the last 20 years, the proportion of the world population living in extreme poverty has A. almost doubled, B. remained more or less the same, C. almost halved. The correct answer is C. Over the last 20 years, the proportion of people living in extreme poverty has almost halved. But in our online polls in most countries, less than 10% knew this. Remember the four income levels from Chapter 1? In the year 1800, roughly 85% of humanity lived on level 1, in extreme poverty. All over the world, people simply did not have enough food. Most people went to bed hungry several times a year. Across Britain and its colonies, children had to work to eat. And the average child in the United Kingdom started work at age 10. One-fifth the entire Swedish population, including many of my relatives, fled starvation to the United States, and only 20% of them ever returned. When the harvest failed, and your relatives, friends, and neighbors starved to death, what did you do? You escaped. You migrated. If you could. Level 1 is where all of humanity started. It's where the majority always lived. Until 1966. Until then, extreme poverty was the rule, not the exception. The extreme poverty rate has been falling since 1800, and in the last 20 years, extreme poverty dropped faster than ever in world history. In 1997, 42% of the population of both India and China were living in extreme poverty. By 2017 in India, that share had dropped to 12%. There were 270 million fewer people living in extreme poverty than there had been just 20 years earlier. In China, that share dropped to a stunning 0.7% over the same period, meaning another half a billion people crossed over this crucial threshold. Meanwhile, Latin America took its proportion from 14% to 4%, another 35 million people. while all estimates of extreme poverty are very uncertain. When the change appears to be like this, then beyond all doubt, something huge is happening. How old were you 20 years ago? Close your eyes for a second and remember your younger self. How much has your world changed? A lot? A little? Well, this is how much the world has changed. Just 20 years ago, 29% of the world population lived in extreme poverty. Now that number is 9%. Today, almost everybody has escaped hell. The original source of all human suffering is about to be eradicated. We should plan a party. A big party. And when I say we, I mean humanity. Instead, we are gloomy. On our level 4 TVs, we still see people in extreme poverty, and it seems that nothing has changed. Billions of people have escaped misery and become consumers and producers for the world market. Billions of people have managed to slide up from levels 1 to levels 2 and 3 without the people on level 4 noticing. Life expectancy. Fact question 4. What is the life expectancy of the world today? A. 50 years. B. 60 years. C. 70 years. Showing all the causes of deaths and suffering in one number is nearly impossible. But the average life expectancy gets very close. Every child death, every premature death from man-made or natural disasters, every mother dying in childbirth, and every elderly person's prolonged life is reflected in this measure. Back in 1800, when Swedes starved to death and British children worked in coal mines, life expectancy was roughly 30 years everywhere in the world. That was what it had been throughout history. Among all babies who were ever born, roughly half died during their childhood. Most of the other half died between the ages of 50 and 70. So the average was around 30. It doesn't mean most people live to be 30. It's just an average. And with averages, we must always remember that there's a spread. The average life expectancy across the world today is 70. Actually, it's better than that. It's 72. This is one of those questions where the better educated you are, the more ignorant you seem to be. In most countries where we tested, members of the public just about beat the chimps. But in our more highly educated audiences, the most popular answer was 60 years. That would have been correct if you had asked the question in 1973, the year when 200,000 people starved to death in Ethiopia. But we asked it in this decade, more than 40 years of progress later. People live on average 10 years longer now. We humans have always struggled hard to make our families survive, and finally we are succeeding. When I show this in a graph, people often ask, what is the most recent dip there? And they point at 1960. If you don't know already, this is a great opportunity for me to attack the misconception that the world is getting worse. There's a dip in the global life expectancy curve in 1960 because 15 to 40 million people, nobody knows the exact number, starved to death that year in China, in what was probably the world's largest ever man-made famine. The Chinese harvest in 1960 was smaller than planned because of a bad season combined with poor governmental advice about how to grow crops more effectively. The local governments didn't want to show bad results, So they took all the food and sent it to the central government. There was no food left. 1 year later, the shocked inspectors were delivering eyewitness reports of cannibalism and dead bodies along roads. The government denied that its central planning had failed, and the catastrophe was kept secret by the Chinese government for 36 years. It wasn't described in English to the outside world until 1996. Think about it. Could any government keep the death of 15 million people a global secret today? Even if the Chinese government had told the world about this tragedy, the UN World Food Program, which today distributes food to wherever it's most needed in the world, couldn't have helped. It wasn't created until 1961. The misconception that the world is getting worse is very difficult to maintain when we put the present in its historical context. We shouldn't diminish the tragedies of the droughts and famines happening right now, but knowledge of the tragedies of the past should help everyone realize how the world has become both much more transparent and much better at getting help to where it's needed. I was born in Egypt. My home country of Sweden is today on level 4 and one of the richest and healthiest countries in the world, but it hasn't always been so. Saying that a country is on level 4 means that the average person in that country is on level 4. It doesn't mean that everyone in Sweden is on level 4. Remember, averages disguise spreads. The World Health Chart is my favorite graph, and it is like a world map of health and wealth. Each country is represented by a bubble, with the size of the bubble showing the size of the country's population. Poor countries are on the left, and richer countries are on the right. Healthier countries are higher up, and sicker countries are lower down. There are not two groups. The world is not divided into two. There are countries on all levels, all the way from the sick and poor in the bottom left corner to the rich and healthy in the top right corner, where Sweden is. And most countries are in the middle. Now this next bit is exciting. The trail of little bubbles shows Sweden's health and wealth for every year since 1800. What tremendous progress! 1948 was a very important year. The Second World War was over, Sweden topped the medals table at the Winter Olympics, and I was born. The Sweden I was born into in 1948 was where Egypt is on the health wealth map today. That is to say, it was right in the middle of level 3. Life conditions in 1950s Sweden were similar to those in Egypt or other countries on level 3 today. There were still open sewage ditches, and it wasn't uncommon for children to drown in bodies of water close to home. On level 3, parents work hard, away from their children, and the government has not yet enforced regulations to protect water with fences. Sweden kept improving during my lifetime. During the 1950s and 1960s, it progressed all the way from Egypt today to Malaysia today. By 1975, the year Anna and Ola were born, Sweden, like Malaysia today, was just about to enter level 4. Let's go backward now. When my mother was born, in 1921, Sweden was like Zambia is now. That's level 2. My grandmother was the Lesothian member of our family. When she was born in 1891, Sweden was like Lesotho is today. That's the country with the shortest life expectancy in the world today, right on the border between level 1 and 2, almost in extreme poverty. My grandmother hand-washed all the laundry for her family of 9 all her adult life. But as she grew older, she witnessed the miracle of development as both she and Sweden reached level 3. By the end of her life, she had an indoor cold water tap and a latrine bucket in the basement, luxury compared to her childhood, where there had been no running water. All 4 of my grandparents could spell and count, but none of them was literate enough to read for pleasure. They couldn't read children's books to me, nor could they write a letter. None of them had had more than 4 years of school. Sweden in my grandparents' generation had the same level of literacy that India, also on level 2, has achieved today. My great-grandmother was born in 1863, when Sweden's average income level was like today's Afghanistan, right on level 1, with the majority of the population living in extreme poverty. Great-grandmother didn't forget to tell her daughter, my grandmother, how cold the mud floor used to be in the winter. But today, people in Afghanistan and other countries on level 1 live much longer lives than Swedes did back in 1863. This is because basic modernizations have reached most people and improved their lives drastically. They have plastic bags to store and transport food. They have plastic buckets to carry water and soap to kill germs. Most of their children are vaccinated. On average, they live 30 years longer than Swedes did in 1800, when Sweden was on level 1. That is how much life, even on level 1, has improved. Your own country has been improving like crazy, too. I can say this with confidence, even though I don't know where you live, because every country in the world has improved its life expectancy over the last 200 years. In fact, almost every country has improved by almost every measure. 32 more improvements. Is the world in your head still getting worse? Then get ready for a challenging data encounter. I have 32 more improvements to show you. You can track the progress of your country or any country online, using the freely available tool we use to create our bubble charts, found at www.gapminder.org/tools. It is hard to see any of this global progress by looking out your window. It is taking place beyond the horizon. But there are some clues you can tune into if you pay close attention. Listen carefully. Can you hear a child practicing the guitar or the piano? That child has not drowned and is instead experiencing the joy and freedom of making music. The goal of higher income is not just bigger piles of money. The goal of longer lives is not just extra time. The ultimate goal is to have the freedom to do what we want. Me? I love the circus, and playing computer games with my grandchildren, and zapping through TV channels. Culture and freedom, the goals of development, can be hard to measure, but guitars per capita is a good proxy, and boy has that improved. With beautiful statistics like those, how can anyone say the world is getting worse? In 1962, there were only 200 playable guitars per million people in the world. By 2014, that number had shot up to 11,000. The negativity instinct. In large part, it is because of our negativity instinct, our instinct to notice the bad more than the good. There are 3 things going on here. The misremembering of the past, selective reporting by journalists and activists, and the feeling that as long as things are bad, it's heartless to say they are getting better. Warning. objects in your memories were worse than they appear. For centuries, older people have romanticized their youths